to City's Edge where half the band can show up and we still have so much musical talent they don't know what instrument they're supposed to be playing.
That's a lot of talent.
In a whole lot of churches. Thanks, guys. That was awesome. So today, Dan is in Idaho. The church did not split, despite what Chris Miller wanted to believe. He's off doing a camp in Idaho, so you get to hear from me this morning. But we're going to follow the regular pattern of our Quaker liturgy, and we'll be reading the scripture, because we like the Bible, and then we'll have a drama, and then I'll come back up here and tell you what I think is going on here. So we are in, I'm losing my microphone here. We are in the book of 1 Samuel, and last week we left off on kind of a bummer. Brooks made a wonderful message out of this, which if you haven't heard, I recommend you listen to online where it is present. But the end of the story is not particularly great. The Ark of God has been captured by the Philistines. The priestly family that we've been following has been wiped out. And there's a baby born, which ought to be a happy occurrence, but its mother names him "The Glory Has Departed," Ichabod, which I don't know about you, but it's kind of a bummer of a name. You have to go through life, people, hearing your name is "The Glory Has Departed." Not a whole lot of fun. But we pick up the story here, where the Ark has been captured, and this is an interesting passage in that there is really nothing Israelite about this. We're going to hear a story about the Ark of the Covenant that God made with Israel, in which an Israelite does not appear. There are no Israelites in this story. But I'm going to read this, and rather than jumping into my sermon now, I'll let the drama team do their thing. So 1 Samuel 5, it's the entire chapter. After the Philistines captured the Ark of God, they took it from the battleground at Ebenezer to the town of Ashdod. They carried the Ark of God into the temple of Dagon and placed it beside an idol of Dagon. But when the citizens of Ashdod went in to see it the next morning, Dagon had fallen with his face to the ground in front of the Ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and put him in his place again. But the next morning, the same thing happened. Dagon had fallen face down before the Ark of the Lord again. This time, his head and hands had broken off and were lying in the doorway. Only the trunk of his body was left intact. That is why, to this day, neither the priests of Dagon nor anyone who enters the temple of Dagon in Ashdod will step on its threshold. Then the Lord's heavy hand struck the people of Ashdod and the nearby villages with a plague of tumors. When the people realized what was happening, they cried out, "We can't keep the Ark of the God of Israel here any longer. He is against us. We will all be destroyed, along with Dagon, our God." So they called together the rulers of the Philistine towns and asked, "What should we do with the Ark of the God of Israel?" The rulers discussed it and replied, "Move it to the town of Gath." So they moved the Ark of God of Israel to Gath. But when the Ark arrived at Gath, the Lord's heavy hand fell on its men, young and old, and he struck them with a plague of tumors, and there was a great panic. So they sent the Ark to the town of Ekron. But when the people of Ekron saw it coming, they cried out, "They are bringing the Ark of the God of Israel here to kill us too!" The people summoned the Philistine rulers again and begged them, "Please, send the Ark of the God of Israel back to its own country, or it will kill us all." For the deadly plague from God had already begun, and great fear was sweeping across the town. Those who didn't die were afflicted with tumors, and the cry from the town rose to heaven. I think that's the last slide.
That is the last slide.
The bottom line got cut off. That says heaven after that. All right, drama team. You guys all have fun in your various locations. Let me set this down over here. So, today's story is really kind of depressing as well, although less so for the Israelites since they don't appear in it. But for the Philistines. The Philistines have a rough go here. And before we get into what exactly happens here, I wanted to talk about who the Philistines are. Because throughout the story that we'll find in the books of Samuel, as we go through the story of Samuel and Saul and David, the Philistines are going to figure fairly prominently. And it's kind of interesting to look at who are these guys. Because they're not the Canaanite nation, which God had told the Israelites to drive out when they came to the Promised Land. This is an entirely different group. And they really haven't figured in the story very largely until the tail end of the book of Judges. Which they first start to appear during the story of Samson. So I wanted to take a minute and review kind of who were the Philistines and give you guys a history lesson, because I like history, and I always feel an obligation when I have a chance to talk about history to do so in a way that hopefully will fix some of the perception that history is dull, because it's not. So go ahead and throw my map up there, the first map I have on there. So the Philistines, during the time of Israel, they live near Israel, but before that, they were a semi-nomadic people. They actually originated up, here's a map of the Eastern Mediterranean. You can see Crete up there, and then Greece is above Crete, and they actually originated as a people group up in Greece. They were a displaced minority group from Greece. They migrated to Crete. They're known as Kaphtarites, and they became pirates. They literally became Aegean pirates based in Greece for a few hundred years. They sort of harassed all of the city-states and also the northern coast of Africa. Now, eventually, so they were literally Cretan pirates. I mean, really. So they eventually got pushed off Crete. The more native tribes of Crete decided they didn't like these guys, and they eventually got pushed off Crete, and they migrated down to the northern coast of Egypt, and they got engaged in a war with the pharaoh. Several of the pharaohs engaged in a war with this group of Kaphtarites that had migrated to northern Egypt, and eventually the pharaohs won. So the pharaohs defeated these Kaphtarite tribes, and they made them sort of a subclass. They weren't as oppressed as the story of the Israelites, where they were literally enslaved in the core of the country. They were subjugated, but they were placed in strategic cities around the Egyptian Empire, which at the time included the southern part of what would become the land of Israel. And an important city in that area that got populated with these Cretan pirates was Gaza. So that city was a stronghold of Egypt originally, and it sort of got reconstructed as a city for this displaced tribe. Eventually, the power of Egypt sort of receded. Might have had something to do with some plagues. I don't know. Some big disaster where their whole army got drowned in the Red Sea. Anyway, the Egyptian Empire kind of collapsed at one point, and this group gained independence. And they took over the southern part of the coastal region of what would later be Israel. And they ended up with five pretty important cities down there. Among them were Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gaza, a couple of others. So that's the origin of the Philistines. The name Philistine comes about quite a bit later, but that's where these people came from. And when they took over that area, when the Egyptian Empire sort of collapsed, they didn't populate, that area was not populated solely with Philistines. There were all of these other smaller people groups, and these guys were kind of invaders. They were used by the Egyptians as a kind of occupying military force. So the Philistines, when the Egyptians went away, they said, oh, well, I guess we're in charge now. And they became a kind of upper class that controlled a lot of the lower classes of native people groups to that part of what would now be Israel. So the Philistines were usurpers, pirates, thieves, and nobles. They were basically the ruling class. That's what they did. That was their MO. And we know a little bit about how they operated from a story that shows up in the book of Judges, the story of Samson. Because Samson had a number of engagements with the Philistines, some of them good, some of them not so good. One of those engagements ended poorly. Several of them ended poorly, but one of them was literally a marriage engagement, and that definitely ended poorly.
But it really brought down the house.
Yeah, that didn't go well. But do you remember the end of the story of Samson? Samson has been captured by the Philistines after Delilah cut his hair, and he's put in the temple of Dagon in Ashdod. So, and the story is that he's there and he's blinded, and his last act is an act of terrible vengeance, where he cries out to God and says, "Let me have revenge on my enemies," and he pushes the pillars over and the temple collapses and kills thousands of people, and go Samson. The guy was just a disaster. But the point is that the behavior of the Philistines towards Samson was fairly typical of their behavior towards their enemies. They liked to put on a show with their defeated people. The Philistines, and this is pretty universal among ancient peoples, and particularly in Greece, where these guys came from, when you defeated your enemy, you took them on a parade. You showed them off. We beat them. Hey, look, we're better than these guys. Let's go marching around the countryside and show how great we are. Now, it ended poorly in Samson's case, and it turns out it's going to end poorly here, too. So this group of cretin pirates that have taken over the land have gotten in a war with the people of Israel. This is several hundred years later, since they took over the territory. So they're kind of nativized at this point. You know, they've become a known people group. Everyone kind of knows the Philistines are around. They have their cities and their spot. I think I have another map that's more zoomed in on the Philistine territory. Yeah, those cities in green, Gath, Ekron, Ashdod, Aphek, Ebenezer, or Ashkelon, those cities were the Philistine territory. And they would take defeated peoples around sort of a cycle of their major cities and their five kings, and they'd show them off. So when the Philistines capture the Ark of God, that big green arrow sort of pointed at Ebenezer, you can see up there, is where our last story ended. Ebenezer, the Israelites go out with the Ark of God, and they get defeated, and the Philistines capture it, and they take it to Ashdod. So if you're an Israelite at this point in the story, it's pretty depressing. This is probably it's about the lowest point that Israel gets before they're exiled to Babylon. Their symbol of their promise with God has been captured. Their priestly line has been basically wiped out. Their sacrificial system, which is how they gain access to their God, the very core of it is their high priest, whose line has been basically wiped out, goes into their most holy place where their Ark of the Covenant is, which has been captured by the enemy. It's about as low a point as it gets for Israel. They have no way to interface with their God anymore. So it's a really depressing time to be an Israelite. Now, if you look at the story and how it built up to this, they kind of deserved it, right? I mean, Eli was a pretty rotten priest, and his sons were even worse. And their behavior with the Ark was not correct.
Trying to use it like a Dungeons and Dragons magic item.
They were. They're trying to use it like an artifact from Dungeons and Dragons. So let's actually have the Ark up there. Let's get a picture of the Ark. So this is a picture I pulled off a website that actually sells these.
Sweet.
People love the Ark of the Covenant. They love to talk about where it is. They love to talk about what happened to it. They love to talk about how it melts Nazis' faces. People love the Ark of the Covenant. They love to talk about it. Now, and to sell jewelry box versions of it with little tablets and little things of manna and little rods of Aaron. So, to sort of unwind this, I want to talk about what this actually was. Because I can tell you it is not a Nazi melting artifact. That is not its primary role in the story of God. The Ark of the Covenant had a very specific purpose in Israelite society. I mentioned it, that it was the place where their high priest interacted with God. Now, they had received instructions directly from God on how to do this. It was really specific. Those of you who have been reading my blog have heard all of this, that I really feel like the entire purpose of the books of Moses was to point the people of Israel towards the tabernacle and towards the tent of meeting in which there was the Ark of the Covenant, where they could meet with God. That they had been separated from God, and this was the way they could come and meet with God. So the Ark of the Covenant was, it literally contains stone tablets with the covenant on them. It's the Ark of the Covenant in the sense that it contains it. It has the Ark, the covenant inside of it. And on top of it, there's these angels, and God says there's a seat there. God calls it this, well, it's Hebrew, and it got translated into German and then into English, and comes out mercy seat. The seat of God, it's God's seat. It's literally God's throne. This is where God sits. So the function of the Ark of the Covenant in the Old Testament, when it's first put together, what is this? What is the tabernacle? If God's throne is in there, what's the tabernacle? This is God's throne room. God's throne room. This is where you would go to talk to your God, to your king. This is God's throne. So the function of the Ark is to say, this is where God is, and his rule is based, literally sits on top of, a covenant, a promise that God made with Israel. That's literally what it is. Now, there are many recreations of the tabernacle. This is among my favorites. A very authentic Lego creation. I don't, that guy, Simon Pickard, apparently did this. Created a very faithful representation of the tabernacle using Legos. It's absolutely excellent. There's a little ark up there. It's really, it's great. It's kind of hard to see up here, but look it up online. It's awesome. I love Legos. So the people of Israel had started using, as David mentioned, the Ark of the Covenant as a talisman, as an artifact, as something that could be used to get what they wanted. But what was it meant to be? It was supposed to represent their point of interaction with God. God was supposed to meet them there. That was what the purpose of the ark was. And when you get to Hophni and Phinehas, the sons of Eli, they've taken it out of its context. They've pulled it right out of the tabernacle where God, they were supposed to meet with God, and they've used it inappropriately. And as Brooks talked about last week, when that happens, when God's throne, when God's temple is used wrongly, God drains it of its power. God takes away the thing that made it special. So when they tried to use the ark that way, it went really badly. It all fell apart. But it still had the covenant inside of it. It still had the manna inside of it. It still had the rod of Aaron. Now, the covenant, the manna, and the rod of Aaron were symbols. Obviously, no one was looking in the ark. At least, well, some people try here in a couple of chapters. It doesn't go well. But you have this promise that God made with Israel. You have miraculous provision given by God to Israel. And you have the rod of Aaron symbolizing that God has made a way for humans to interact with him. And the ark is still the symbol of that for ancient Israel. They don't have another one. This is the one they have. And now it's in the hands of the Philistines, the Cretan pirates. So what now? Well, the Israelites drop out of the story at this point. Their actions have no bearing on what's about to happen. And that's, we're going to come back to that, and that's going to be important. But the Philistines see this, and what do? They take it to the Temple of Dagon. So let's talk about Dagon for a minute. He's an interesting character. Because Dagon shows up actually all over the Middle East. He's not just a local deity of the Philistines. He originated, very possibly, in Crete, because there's a Dagon in Crete. And there's a Dagon in Assyria, and there's a Dagon in Babylon, and there's a Dagon in Philistia. So where did he come from? Well, we don't have an exact representation of what Dagon looked like at this time. You may have seen one occasionally, though. People think that he was sort of a fish god, and they show him as a sort of merman. Well, that's the Cretan history, because there was a legend that Dagon was descended from one of the Greco-Roman gods of the sea. And the word Dag, that piece of the Ugaritic word that his name comes from, means fish. But that image doesn't show up in archaeology. Somebody came up with that in the 14th century. So we don't really know that that's what it looked like. And what we do know is that there was a Phoenician writer who pointed out that, well, had some documents that said Dagon was a god of grain, an inventor of the plow in Assyria. So he's a grain god in one place, he's a fish god in another place. It's just pieces of things. And then he shows up here in Philistia. So where'd he come from? Well, he's kind of an amalgamation god at this point. And as time goes on, the Philistines will become more and more associated with the worship of Dagon as both a grain and fish god. So those pieces are both there. And Dagon takes on the qualities of the people, of the gods of the people they conquer. So by this time, the Philistines were used to conquering a people, looking around, saying, I like that god, I'll take that one. We'll just add it to Dagon. We've got a god we like, but we'll just keep adding pieces to him. Yeah, this is a fish god, we're a sea people, but now we're on the land, maybe we need some grain pieces. We'll capture a grain god and we'll add some pieces to him. So when the Philistine people capture the ark, what do? Well, this god was cool. We know what he did in Egypt. Let's add him to Dagon. Let's stick him in the temple here with Dagon, and we'll figure a way to graft him on here. We'll take the qualities we like from this god, and we'll add it to ours. That was their practice. That's what they were used to doing. And God's response is very direct. So the Philistines drop the ark in there, and they're like, well, we're gonna graft this god onto Dagon. They go away, and the next day they come back, and what has happened? Their god fell over. He lost his balance. So, but you're a good Philistine, and you're a good worshiper of Dagon, and you're like, oops, well, maybe there was like some sort of ground tremor or whatever. We're going to set the god back up. So, you know, you pick the god up, and you set him back up, and you're like, okay. The next day, the same things happen. And what's interesting here is that the breaking off of the head and hands of Dagon, the Hebrew is actually interesting. It doesn't actually say his head and hands broke off and all that was left was his trunk. What it says is Dagon had fallen over and lost his head and hands, and all that was left to him was Dagon. That's actually what it says. So God had not only said, I'm not a part of this god, but in breaking off the pieces of Dagon, I believe was saying something along the lines of, you guys aren't even worshiping one thing. You're worshiping the pieces of something that you've mashed together. That your god isn't even coherent. He's fallen to pieces. And there's some interesting things about the meaning of the word hand and head there. That he lost his lordship, he'd lost his power, which is represented by hands. But the point is that the God of Israel is saying, no, this is not what you get to do. You don't get to just put me into a box with these other gods and make me part of your worship ceremony. You don't get to do that with me. Now, the very capture of the ark is the same message. When the Israelites brought the ark out to go to war with the Philistines, and God let them to defeat it, what was he saying to them? You don't get to manipulate me. You don't get to use me like this. And then the Philistines take the Ark of the Covenant and they put it in their temple. And God says, no, you don't get to manipulate me. You don't get to use me. That's not how this works. Now, the Philistines, give them a little bit of credit. they realized what was happening. And they said, oh, this is not a safe place for us to keep this thing. Give them a little bit of credit for realizing that we can't overcome this. We're going to have to do something with it. But then this story takes a weird turn. Because, like I said, the Philistines were used to, when they captured somebody, in great Greek tradition, of going on a victory lap, going on a victory tour. We beat this thing, let's go on a victory tour and show it off. What happens in this story? It's kind of this reverse victory tour. So we can't get rid of it fast enough. We don't know what to do with this thing. We've realized we can't keep it. It's bigger than us. The thing that this represents is so much more than we can handle. We have to get rid of it as fast as we can. So the people in Ashdod are like, what do we do? Well, let's send it to the guys in Gath. Let's see if they can handle it. And it goes to Gath, and Gath is like, geez, they get struck with a plague. And the story we come to later, the next chapter, about tumors and mice, people have been trying for literally thousands of years to figure out what kind of plague this was, because we like to do that. But generally, people think it was some form of the bubonic plague, maybe, where there were tumors and buboes, like the growths that happen in that, and mice being associated. But the truth is, we don't really know. What we do know is it was pretty darn bad. It was bad enough that when it broke out, they were like, we know where this came from. This ark just came into our town, and this broke out. We got to get rid of it. And as soon as they got rid of it, it went away. So they're like, okay, we know where that came from. But what did they do? They pushed it off to the next Philistine city. So what God is doing here is not only is God showing that he's superior to the piecemeal God of the Philistines, he's kind of undoing their whole process of victory. And like, you guys are used to victory tours, I'll show you a victory. And he ends up touring all of their royal cities, all the cities of their kings, the Ark of God comes to, and just causes disaster to the point where they cannot get rid of it fast enough. Now, why is a story like this in the Bible? What's the point of a story like this if you're an ancient Israelite? You're reading this and going like, okay, so we screwed up real bad. You know, say you're maybe in the time of David or one of his children, and you're like, okay, now I'm reading this story from the book of the prophet Samuel. What's the point? How many Israelites show up in this story? Zero. So if you're an Israelite, what are you supposed to learn?
God is not yours.
God doesn't belong to you. And God's actions are not dependent on you. God's actions are not dependent on you doing something to cause them. God's victories don't come from your decisions. I think a big part of the lesson to be learned here is, in our interactions with God, we're powerless. The Israelites don't even show up in the story of their victory over the Philistines. This is a victory for the Israelites over Philistines in which the Israelites they do not appear in the story. God is teaching a lesson here of saying, your victories are not dependent on you. I am doing this. And we'll find that as the story of the ark goes on here, that theme continues. When the Philistines decide to send the ark back, the Israelites don't come and get it. Where it ends up has nothing to do with them. God tells a story about victory that has no actors in it. It's just the Philistines getting walloped. And there's no characters, no heroes, no one to look at and say, well, that guy really did it. No, God did this all by himself. The covenant that lived inside the ark, that set of promises, was founded on a statement that God makes about his own faithfulness. He as much as predicts in the book of Deuteronomy that you will all be faithless. You will all fail. You will all screw up. And I'm going to be faithful anyway. The lesson for the maybe 10th century BC Israelite, and the lesson for us today really isn't much different. Because this story foreshadows something in the life of Jesus. It foreshadows an action in which God acts alone. A victory that has no human component but Jesus himself. A destruction of our way of thinking about God. It's going to turn the world upside down. Because we act a lot like the Philistines in a lot of ways. As we go through our lives, we pick pieces of belief systems of what we like, and we assemble them together and we turn them into gods. You know, I like what this guy's doing over here, and I like what that guy's doing over there. I'll just mix that up and come up with a belief system that suits me, that's under my control. I'll find my identity in whatever feels like it works for me. But God doesn't work that way. God's victories are his victories. They don't have a human actor. We're not the ones doing them, even when it looks like we are. The lesson for us today is so similar to that of the ancient Israelites. Look at what God is doing and say, is what I am doing lining up with what he is doing? Am I following his will? Am I doing what he would have me to do? Because I can't take God and plug him into my plan. It doesn't work that way. I can't assemble him into a structure I already have of things I already like. I can't have a Dagon over here and take God and plug in the pieces of him that I like. My God's going to fall over. And if I keep at it, my God's going to break into pieces. God doesn't work that way. As humans, when we interact with God, the lesson that we need to learn first and foremost is that we can't. We are powerless. This story showcases the power of God without any input from his people. And as we continue in the book of Samuel, we're going to find more and more that the more the people try and put input into the plan of God, the worse it gets. God has a plan. He's going to do it. It's going to happen. Our influence on that plan is to follow it, not to plug it into what we want to do. So I'd ask you today, as you look at your life, you look at the decisions you make, and you look at the plan you're following, are you trying to plug God into it? Are you trying to take a part of God's plan and God's actions and put it into your plan? Are you being Hophni and Phinehas? Being Eli? Or are you recognizing that God's plan is happening and you have a choice of whether to get on board or not? It's going to look different for each of us. We don't all have the same experience. God does not have the same plan for all of us. We go different directions, and I really believe that God designed you, each and every one of you, to be a kind of person. But you can't get there by claiming it and saying, I'm going to put God into my plan for my life. You have to surrender to God's plan for your life. I have a lot to say about how that happens, but not in this sermon. If you're interested, if you're curious, how do I know? How do I know God's plan for my life? Just ask Beth. Sorry, that was just too easy. I don't think she's even in the room. It was a wasted dig. Now, I really do believe we can find God's plan for our lives by looking at the people around you. We can help each other find this. The pursuit of understanding God's plan is not a solo activity, because that's just our plan. But the people around you, God uses them. The word of God, God uses this. People around you, God uses them to show you where you need to surrender and say, this plan is happening. How can I get on board with it? Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you that you have outlined a plan and that you are following it and that you are faithful. As we attempt to get on board with that plan, we ask you to help us surrender our wills, to get on board with what you're doing, and give us the power to follow you. Amen.